call to order the Senate Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection. Colleagues, today is March 28th, 2011. We are convened for public hearing and possible work session on a number of bills, and I wanted to telegraph to those who may be watching what my intention is as far as order is concerned. So we will start with Senate Bill 48. Second will be Senate Bill 85. Third will be Senate Bill 118. Fourth will be Senate Bill 628. And we're going to do Senate Bill 756 somewhere in there at a time certain of 1:30 so that Senator Berger can come testify. And then I anticipate trying to reserve the last half hour of the hearing for Senate Bill 490, which will go last. So that being said, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 48. Patrick, if you could tee it up for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 48 limits the types of special districts within the Metropolitan Service District over which the Metropolitan Service District exercises jurisdiction for boundary changes. You have in your packets, and were provided ahead of time, the Dash 1 Amendment. I believe the proponents of the measure will be speaking of the Dash 1 Amendment. You also have a minimal fiscal impact statement and a no revenue impact statement for the measure with the Dash 1 Amendment. And so the bill, so all the paperwork that's necessary is in hand, Mr. Chair.
Great, thank you. Could we bring up Randy Tucker and his colleague from Metro?
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Chair Shields, members of the committee, Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. I'm here mainly to introduce my much more distinguished colleague and to remind you that when I spoke to you about this bill, we branded it the world's smallest bill. It's actually not the world's smallest bill, but it is probably the smallest in terms of its intrusion into your workload, I hope. So with that, I'll pass the floor to Dick Bennett.
Good afternoon. My name is Dick Banner. I work at in the attorney's office at Metro, and I'd like to just give you a little bit of background on Senate Bill 48. It won't take much time. At least one of your members knows this very well. Senator Monroe probably knows it better than I do, but some years ago, there used to be boundary commissions around the state, and they were in charge of changes to the boundaries of special districts, annexations to cities, formation of new districts, etc. About 10 years after Metro was formed, the legislature decided that the three counties didn't really need two bodies seeming to do some of the same things, and so it eliminated the Boundary Commission up there, and in the process gave the responsibilities of the Boundary Commission to Metro, with one significant change, and that was a shrinkage of the territory that was subject. Previously, it was the three counties subject to the Boundary Commission. Now that Metro has the responsibility, it's just the service district boundaries, which is considerably less than the three counties. So we took over responsibility for those boundary change decisions and formations and whatnot. And over the years, we've developed a practice of, we've adopted some procedural requirements and some substantive requirements for those boundary changes and formations, etc. But over the years, we've realized that the statute, which used to direct to the Boundary Commission which kinds of boundaries would be subject to them, we've come to realize that a lot of those have very little to do with Metro's mission. For example, vector control districts or library districts. And so there's quite a list in the various statutes, either our statute or the statutes, the references in our statutes to other statutes that have us responsible for changes to the boundaries of geothermal heating districts, for example. Heritage districts, animal control districts, a long list. And as a practical matter, most of those districts don't file their applications for changes to districts, the boundaries with us. We have not imposed our process on them. And this bill would change the list. It would take a lot of those small districts whose activities really don't have anything to do with our activities and our missions, and we would then no longer have jurisdiction over their boundary changes. It doesn't mean that they would have no criteria or no procedures. They derive from other statutes, but they would not have the additional layer that they have today to respond to those statutes, Chapter 199, Chapter 198, but also to our process and our statute. So the overall effect here would be to remove some of the districts, types of districts that are on the list that are now subject to our jurisdiction, take them off that. Those districts then would have no legal obligation to have to come to us if they want to make a boundary change, to follow our process, to pay the fees, et cetera. They would be on their own, again, regulated by these other statutes. So the if you look at the bill, you'll see that there's a more refined list that talks about districts such as water districts, sewer districts, road districts, the kinds of districts whose activities and whose decisions influence or have an effect on the things that Metro is most interested in. So that's basically a summary of what the proposal is. There's an amendment, just one, and we are responsible for it. It was actually an oversight when I first put this together. I did not realize that in the statute, in our statute, which makes a cross-reference to 451.410, it doesn't list water or sanitary services there, but actually that statute does authorize the formation of new such districts and boundary changes to them. And water and sanitary services are services that relate to Metro's principal mission, which is management of growth in the region. So we would propose that amendment to the bill. Okay. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions? Senator Monroe?
Yeah, Dick, those districts that would be removed from Metro's jurisdiction, if they are seeking a boundary change, would they go through the county?
Yes, for the most part.
Okay.
It could be a city if they're in a city, but for
city
the most part,
county.
It'll be a county.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I might add one just brief note. In developing the list of what should be included and what shouldn't, Mr. Benner spoke with the Special Districts Association of Oregon, and I've kept Mr. Landauer of the Special Districts apprised of the amendment as well. And so I, without speaking for them, just wanted to let you know that we've been communicating with them.
If there's no other testimony, I assume that special districts are good, and I'm seeing a nod in the back with the Dash 1 amendment. So, Senator George?
Can we in work session?
Oh, yes. Thank you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 48 and open a work session on Senate Bill 48.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 48 dated February 18, 2011.
Senator George moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 48. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator George?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 48 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved Senate Bill 48 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Debbie, please call the roll.
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Boquist?
Aye.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. Motion passes. Senator George, would you carry that one?
The irony of that, huh? Too bad I can't have Mr. Tucker on the floor with me.
Right. Is the proponent comfortable with Senator George carrying this bill? I will close a work session on Senate Bill 48 and let the record show that Senator George is very excited to carry
eager,
this bill.
Eager.
And I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 85. Patrick?
You planned that all week, didn't you? I know you did.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 85 was a pre-session filed by the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The measure requires manufactured structure dealers to retain earnest monies and other deposits made by retail customers for manufactured structures in a trust until the dealer delivers a structure to the customer. It limits access by persons other than the retail customer to the dealer's surety bond and declares an emergency and would take effect upon passage and signature by the governor. This measure, you have in your packet the Dash 3 amendment. That amendment was requested by the departments. So I suspect they will speak to that amendment, and you also have a no fiscal and no revenue impact statement for the measure with the Dash 3 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Why don't we have the department come up first, David Temp.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm David Tapman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today here in support of Senate Bill 85. You have electronically, I believe, a copy of my testimony. You may be getting a hard copy as well. And this is subject to a Dash 3 amendment. In its simply put, this is a consumer protection bill, and it is not one I believe that comes at the expense of the industry so much as it just assures that consumers are well protected in this situation. Manufactured structured dealers are licensed in the state of Oregon to sell manufactured structured homes. They can do so by brokerage or trading it or acting as an agent for anyone buying or selling. The distinction should be noted, this is different than the sale of the real estate itself. So this is different than real estate sales, and it's a different license, but it's comparable, and the housing markets are comparable, and the two compete with one another. We have a number of exemptions and a modified license for those people who sell to 10 or sell 10 or fewer structures in a year from a manufactured structure park. The reason for this bill is within the recent economic downturn that we've seen, we've had some concerns and we've had complaints brought to our attention by manufactured structured dealers, probably at some point say MSDs, but that's a manufactured structured dealer, who would take money in, and currently the law does not provide for any protection of that money. The money comes in and the money can go into a general operating account, it can go into a person's private bank account. And so we've had circumstances, and I would say roughly a half dozen of those in the last 3 years, in which businesses have received money from consumers and have not been able to account for the money at certain points in the process. They may go out of business, the money may have been misappropriated, and the consumer was left, if you will, holding the bag. And we don't think that's an acceptable business practice. These are regulated entities. And unlike somebody who's purchasing a washing machine or even an automobile, we're talking about somebody who's buying a home. Average price can range anywhere from $58,000 to $81,000, depending on the size and the quality. And that's a substantial amount of money that may be a down payment or a substantial percentage of the money going into escrow. Not going into escrow is the problem, I should say. In addition to that, and I will come back to this client trust account concept, we also are seeking to clarify the use of a surety bond. There's a surety bond that currently stands at $40,000. That bond is subject, though, up to the first $20,000, the first half of it, to be used to help pay if somebody has a claim against the dealer that is not a consumer. So somebody, for instance, that may have a business relationship and may have a beef or a problem with that manufactured structured dealer could pursue the bond up to the first $20,000. We don't think that's appropriate. $40,000 is a relatively low amount for a surety bond, especially if you're buying a piece of a manufactured structure totaling $80,000 or more. One person pursuing that would wipe that bond out. We're asking that the full $40,000 of that bond be made only available to consumers. By the way, there is an alternative in most instances, and as the Construction Contractors Board also requires a bond of $20,000, so most of the service providers would be able to pursue that should they have a reason for recourse. The last component of the bill, just as an overview, involves enforcement, and it's simply it would give us the authority to be able to subpoena records as part of any investigation we may have, a rather standard enforcement tool that we have in almost all the programs we regulate. And we've had a number of instances in the past year where we didn't have the ability to do that. Now, sometimes we can talk somebody into providing the records, but if they choose not to give us the records, our course of action is fairly convoluted to get the information we need. So the subpoena power is an important one, and one that, as I say, is a standard tool within enforcement. And the last component within enforcement would be cease and desist authority. That's administrative authority. Right now, our only recourse if somebody violates the law is to go to court, hire an attorney, have them hire an attorney, and file a lawsuit, which, as you know, is a protracted process and rather expensive. There's an alternative method which most enforcement programs have, and that's administrative actions, cease and desist orders, which are also also subject to due process, but we believe is much more efficient and a better way to go. So getting back to the issue of client trust account, and I want to make a note. One of the reasons why you have a dash three is originally we talked about a client trust account as a fiduciary responsibility, and that's a strong legal concept that somebody owes a special duty to somebody when they are relying on their services. It was explained to us, and it was never our intention to create that legal relationship. That's not the relationship that we wanted. So one of the changes in the Dash 3 is to take the language fiduciary out. But what we do want to do is have an account, and we couldn't come up with a good name, so it's being called a client trust account, but it's essentially a holding account where money would be held that was deposited by the consumer when it came time they wanted to buy something. Typically, the money is used to pay for the structure, the building, I should say, of that manufactured structure down at a factory. And so the money needs to go down there. Originally, our concept was to treat it like a true client trust account and say, when that money comes in, that money sits there until the transaction is finished. And just like when you buy a house, no money goes out until all the parties are satisfied and they write up an escrow agreement. Well, we understand in talking with Mr. Miner, who represents the industry, that could be a death knell for the industry. And that was never our intention. We want that money to go down so they can start the manufacturing process. There are also other sources that money is used for, though. It's used for grading the site where the property is going to be set. It's used for paying for infrastructure. It could be water or sewage or putting in driveway, landscaping, things like that, and it also covers a number of fees and costs, including the fees of transportation. So what we said was, listen, that money should be held until such time as it's time for that money to be released. And it can be released during the interim of the process. But the money shouldn't just go off in somebody's personal account and be used as they choose to. Because for whatever reason, if something doesn't work, if somebody goes out of business, if the manufacturer doesn't make the product, if circumstances radically change, there should be some kind of recourse for the consumer. And up until now, there hasn't been, and it's been problematic. As I mentioned about the surety bond, I think I've covered that adequately. If you have questions, let me know. But it's just to make sure that surety bond was designed initially to provide for consumers. And as I said, $40,000 it pales in comparison to the cost of one manufactured structure. So it doesn't take long to use that up. We talked to Mr. Miner about raising that bond to reflect more accurately the cost. He said that would be also financially problematic. And so we agreed not to raise that up, but to see if we could change it, because we know that those people who are providing business services have an alternative, and that is to go through the Construction Contractors Board to pursue that $20,000 bond. I've talked about the enforcement a little bit. I think that what I want to do is just identify a couple of things within the this client trust account, how it would work. And again, I apologize for the name, but that's the name we've got within the bill right now. It clarifies that all money must be put into that account that are received by the consumers. It requires the dealer to keep records of how that money is utilized, and those records are to be made available to us. It also provides that the money can be withdrawn, as I mentioned, in the interim. And finally, it allows the dealer to keep whatever money is left over at the time the transaction is done. We talked about having to spell out the fees or the commissions they would be earned, and so that the consumer would know how much of that money would be going out. Again, the industry asked that we not do that, so we've agreed not to do that, so it just allows the residue to go to the consumer. Excuse me, go to the dealer at the time the transaction is finished. We believe this will provide substantial consumer protection, and it's a workable process for distributing funds throughout the process of the purchase, construction, and siting of the home. Now, you may hear how the business transaction is no different than buying a washing machine. I would beg to differ with that analogy. The fact that somebody buys a washing machine on a purchase agreement and the washing machine doesn't come into Sears for 3 weeks until it's delivered from Ames, Iowa, or wherever they come from, is a far cry from somebody who is buying a manufactured structure and waiting 1 to 3 months for the property to be constructed and to be delivered, and it's a substantially higher amount than a washing machine. And frankly, this industry is struggling mightily as we speak of it right now. In addition, it's my opinion that this does not create any additional regulatory costs. You set up a second account. You already have a business operating account. This would allow you to set up a second account, and that account would serve as your escrow account. And at its heart, if I may, the section just says that the money must be held in this separate account, apart from the business operational account, and the money is to be withdrawn and distributed only as the services are initiated or concluded, and those steps are documented somewhere in the business's formal records. With that, I'm going to conclude. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have about the Dash 3 amendment, and I'm willing to take questions now, or if you'd like, after other testimony, call me back.
Okay. Thank you. And it sounds like you have a bit of a cold. I appreciate you coming to work despite that, Mr. Tetman. Questions, Senator Monroe?
Okay, so manufactured housing business right now is struggling, like a lot of businesses are, because you've got a situation where somebody contracts to have a manufactured home built for them, and in the meantime, the business goes bankrupt. The money without this bill, the money might very well be lost to the client. Is that correct? And the purpose of your bill would be then to set that money aside and protect the client so that they wouldn't be losing their investment.
Vice Chair George and Senator Monroe, in essence, that's correct. Now, I will say what we're providing for is the money could be sent down to a manufacturer, let's say Palm Harbor, which is a pretty common name, and they file for bankruptcy. This money would have already been sent down to Palm Harbor, and the bankruptcy process would take its course. What we're providing for is if the dealer goes out of business, the person who contracted, much like a real estate broker or a mortgage lender or broker, if they were to go out of business and the money had been sent off, it's sitting in trust and it immediately comes out. So it protects the money, it protects the consumer, just like you said. I'm just not certain what happens should the money actually have gone down to Albany for the actual start of the process. That would be a different vehicle outside. We don't have any control over the builders, just the dealers.
Okay.
Senator Boquist.
How does this, I'm just looking through my build folder here, and I'm not as electronic as everybody else, so as Senator Monroe's over there has a good computer, I've got paper scattered right here, but I'm looking at 4 or 5 emails. How does this impact the manufactured home parks versus, you know, dealers?
Senator Shields, Chair Shields and Senator Boquist, what we understand is each one of those parks may have a limited dealer's license, and that license is limited to 10 or fewer transactions in a year, and it's for a certain subclass. They're not selling new properties. They're selling properties that are used. Usually they're already sited. In many cases, they may be abandoned or the person's moved on. As it stands right now, the law says you're licensed. You have to do this. We don't have an official position one way or the other whether the legislature thinks these limited dealers should be required to have a client trust account or not. I will say this, as I've tried to stress, I don't think this is a huge burden on somebody to set up a client trust account and put the money in a second account and use and spend the money as responsibilities come due. If it is a transaction where it's an arm's length, I've got $15,000 from the bank to purchase this home, and I've got the deed to the home on the other hand, so you've got two parties, and there's no time delay. It should just be a handshake and an exchange of properties. So it shouldn't be a major problem. Mm-hmm. If they are holding onto that money for any length of time, I think that's good business practices to have that set aside. But I will defer to the wisdom of this body to determine whether that special area should be carved out or not. I know that Mr. Miner and his group don't feel there should be exceptions, and I understand their position.
Okay. Senator George, then we're going to move on.
David, thank you very much for coming by my office, talking to me about that. And what I went over this bill, where I keep getting hung up is right now, in most businesses, people take deposits, and it goes into their general operating capital. And in fact, sometimes the banks look at that as a way they can leverage additional dollars because they have a certain amount of working capital in there. That's why people take deposits. By moving this over to a special account, what you're going to do is stress these companies even more on their ability to borrow money, I think. And it takes away their flexibility in their financing, internal financing. And this is an industry that's already sort of on the tipping point. And I don't want to vote for something that tips them over and puts people out of work at this point. So the only part of the bill that I'm really having a problem with, the rest of the regulatory stuff I think is appropriate, is this basically was a client trust account, mm-hmm. where you're isolating these dollars away from their operating revenue. And I don't see this really applied to a lot of other industries. Like, when you get married, you give a deposit to your person who's arranging your wedding. But if they go bankrupt, you lose all that money. I'm trying to figure out in my mind rationally why this should be applied to this type of business, but not other businesses out there. It just seems like we're sort of picking on these guys, and they're already under an immense amount of stress, and they're already regulated by a couple different branches of government, both on the contractor side and the dealer side. So that's the part of this bill I'm having a problem with, is that special account. And because I think we're going to tip them over and make them, we could make businesses go out of business here in Oregon.
Well, if I may speak to that.
Please.
Chair Shields and Senator George, just a couple of points. One, although the cost of a wedding today is getting astronomical, it's still not the cost of buying, if you will, a home. An $81,000 manufactured structured home is a lot of money, and I don't know that in most instances, there's going to be funding done through that. But that funding is going to go through a third party. They're going to get bank financing or other sources of financing. And so I think that there are some distinctions between the amount of money involved. But more importantly, I want to draw to your attention the fact that what I believe you're really focused on are the manufacturers themselves. There are 10 companies licensed to manufacture in the state of Oregon. They're the ones that are building it. They're the ones that need the cash to make this happen. There are 256 dealer licenses. And much like mortgage lenders or real estate brokers, they're the ones that are putting the dealers together. They'll help the consumer put the financing together. They'll help them select the different advantages and styles and aesthetics they're looking for, but they're not the ones that are really going to be putting all the money into the operation. They aren't borrowing the money. They're the ones that are just acting as the go-between. In those instances, if you think about it, real estate and mortgage lenders and, for that instance, attorneys, they all are required to put that money in there until such time as they've earned it. I think they're closer to that than they are to the ones who need the money to go forward and manufacture that particular structure. If this was a direct one-for-one, there's one dealer for every manufacturer, I think I would share your concerns. But where there's 256 and many of them are independent, they're just brokering on behalf of the supposedly the client to find the best deal for them among these various manufacturers. And I believe that that money should be earmarked for those purposes and those purposes only. I don't believe they're engaged in that financing. I believe that's the manufacturer's responsibility, and they need the borrowing power that you were describing.
Thanks. All right, David, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
I did promise that we would do Senate Bill 756 at a time certain. So, David, do you have time to hang around for a while?
I do. Okay. I'll be here for you.
All right, thank you very much. So, colleagues, and we have Senator Berger who is waiting to testify on Senate Bill 756. So if the opponents will bear with us for a little bit, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 85, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 756, and we'll come right back to Senate Bill 85 shortly. Senator Berger? Welcome to the committee.
Chair Shields, Senator Bonamici, Senator George, Senator Monroe, and Senator Boquist. I am, for the record, Joanne Berger, and I represent Senate District 5. I'd like for my colleagues to know that every session since I have been in the legislature, I have asked my young staff to come up with innovative and creative ideas and have a bill at the end of the time that they have done a lot of thinking, a lot of research, and that I would put my name on that bill and I would help them get it through. This session, it is Senate Bill 756. Oregon is not a fuddy-dud state. We are a Star Wars state. We don't turn away from wonderful ideas that maybe people offhand think that'll never work. We look at them and see with the idea that it can work. You have a copy, a letter that was sent to you. And in the essence of time, I'm not going to go into the details of the bill. I will ask Josh Savvy to join me and talk to you for about a couple of amendments. All I want to say to you is that this staff have done the research. They came up with the idea, just as one of my staff members a few sessions back came up with the expansion of the bottle bill. So they will. They have lobbied the bill. They have gotten the signers onto the bill. And I am very happy today to be here to present the bill to you on their behalf. And Josh? You will tell the committee about your two amendments.
Yeah, my name is Josh Savvy, for the record, policy advisor to Senator Verger. There's actually one amendment. It's a dash one amendment, and this bill has two sections to it, essentially. One requiring gift cards to be reloadable. The intent of that is for the electronic gift cards, so the amendment just stipulates that it's for electronic cards only and not for paper gift certificates. The second piece of this amendment would exempt gift cards that were given for free for promotional or donation purposes from a refund of the
$10. Okay. All right. Nice work. Thank you very
much.
Thank you. Let's see. Why don't we plug on with the people who are here to testify on this, and we'll come back to 48. Could we bring up John Bartholomew, please? And Keith Dubanovich.
You want to go first? All right. Okay. Chairman Shields, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I'm a policy advocate with the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, OSPIRG. We have thousands of members across the state of Oregon. And thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 756. This is really a basic consumer protection bill. The piece that I really want to focus on is the issue is the provision that requires retailers to return cash to the consumer if the balance goes below $10. The general premise is that consumers deserve to get the full value of one of these gift cards without having to purchase something they don't want, need, or spend more money beyond the value of the card to get the full value of it. This really gives the consumers the right to spend that little remainder in a way that is more appropriate to their personal situation. And it still works out for the company that the retailer or the restaurant as well, because they use the brunt of the card. And this is not a brand new idea. This is something that is being done in several other states already. Our neighbors to the north have a $5 threshold. Our neighbors to the south have a $10 threshold. States like Maine and Colorado and Montana are already doing this, and it's working well in those states as well. I think it's a very simple premise that is good for consumers to be able to get their full value from a gift card. Thank you.
Well done.
Mr. Benevich.
Chair Shields, my name is Keith Dubanovich. I'm Chief of Staff to Attorney General Kroger. We appreciate Senator Verger bringing this bill forward, and when we started doing our research, we recognized that not only is this bill good for consumers, but frankly, it's also good for the environment. One of the things that we recognized is that there are approximately, we saw a statistic of 10 billion gift cards that are made every year. Well, they're relatively small, so most of us probably don't give much thought to the impact of those 10 billion cards. But when you drill down and recognize that they're made out of PVC, polyvinyl chloride, which is a potentially toxic substance, and that most of these end up in our landfills, you start to recognize that that's creating a potentially large mess in our landfill. And then if we also recognize that, like most other plastics, the way these are made is out of oil. And if you just simply do the math of 10 billion plastic cards times apparently 4.25 grams of petroleum to manufacture each credit card, we're talking about 425,000 barrels of oil used to make gift cards every year. A lot of oil. And given the turmoil in the Middle East, anything we can do to reduce the consumption of oil is probably good for our economy. As my colleague to the right mentioned, the reality is that this is good for consumers because if you're like me, you have some gift cards with a couple of dollars left on them and you end up never using that gift card. Either because you don't have additional money to go buy something that might be $20 or $30 or $40, but you've only got $2 left on your gift card. By being able to get the money back, it actually is good for consumers. On the environmental impact, the industry is apparently already starting to address this. They're coming up with recyclable cards so that you can put them back into the stream of commerce by grinding them up and making them back into other plastics. They're making biodegradable cards. For those of us, not me, but for those of you that are very tech savvy, there are e-gift cards that you can download to your iPod. So the industry is recognizing that the plastic is not necessarily the best way to go. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Smith, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Jefferson Smith, the record, representing District 47, the Oregon Legislature. I'll be mercifully brief. I just want to say thank you to Senator Verger and the proponents of this bill. I think getting coming to grips a bit with what we're doing with gift cards makes a lot of sense. Like your districts, and I know like your district, Senator Monroe, we have multiple targets, and now they have the turnstiles, right? It's no longer just a way to get sort of a, hey, would you like also a gift card for Christmas when you're at a dinner or when you're at a particular store? Then I have the turnstile where for 100 stores you can buy these things. It's become a significant industry, and I think, which isn't a bad thing, but we should make sure it's smart. We should make sure it's not taking unfair advantage of consumers, and I want to really applaud the proponents of the bill and the drafters of the bill.
Thank you. Senator Bonamici, then Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, and thanks to Senator Verger for bringing the bill forward. We worked on a similar bill in a prior session. I have a question. Since Representative Smith raised this issue, I'll ask him about the turnstile. So if I go into a place like a Fred Meyer and I buy a gift card there, and then it has money left on it, let's say it's for the Gap, do I go to the Gap to get the refund, or do I go to Fred Meyer? And what happens if it's one of the, like a Visa reusable card that can be used at any store? Where do I go to get the refund?
Thank you, Senator Bonamici and Chair Shields. If I could, I'll take a stab at an answer and then turn it over to Keith, who's smarter than me. And then with the chair's leave, committee right now, if I can sneak away and avoid any other hard questions, I'll take that opportunity. All I'll say is this. From my understanding, eager to be corrected, it is a deal between the retailer and the turnstile retailer, the Target, and whomever it is, so that the gift card has a direct link to the, it's not a Target gift card that's for benefit of Starbucks. It's a Starbucks gift card that exists at Target. So the relationship would still be with the home-based company. That's my impression. Beyond that, I'd turn it over to Keith and sneak back to the hearing.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Fortunately, there's nothing for me to correct, but Josh is the brain power on it, and I think he's absolutely correct. If you buy a Starbucks card at 7-Eleven, you would go back to Starbucks to refill that card.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Boquist.
Just a follow-up question for that, and I think Josh will probably be the closest one in the end, but the Visa doesn't have a store, and since it's one of my favorite big multinational banks, which I love so much, according to Senator George, I think that one needs to be answered. And the second question, how did we come upon $5 or $10 when the state of Washington is $5? Is there a magic threshold? And the third question is, how many complaints do we have? I'm sure they're out there. Or is that DCBS that takes those complaints?
I can't. I'm sorry. Chair Shields, Senator Boquist, I can't answer those questions. Fortunately, Josh can.
Well, if you weren't wearing a green tie.
Well, I'll try. Senator Boquist, the current statute doesn't include Visa gift cards or any other type of card from a bank. It's for a single retailer.
Okay.
That's how the statute's worded. As far as $10, that's what California had. We'd be willing to look at $5 if the committee chose.
If it gets you some votes, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Senator Boquist, follow-up.
Just follow-up. So California's, what's our surrounding states here? California's 10, Washington's 5.
Correct.
What about Idaho and Nevada?
I'm not aware of a statute in Idaho or Nevada.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for the record, I'm not a real fan of these cards. My wife gets ripped off all the time by these things.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony, gentlemen.
Thank you.
All right, and we're going to keep plugging along here. Could we get Jim Craven and Elise Brown and Betsy Earls? And then after that, we'll do Sean Miller and his panel.
Where's my favorite banker?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Craven representing Tech America. We're a national trade association that represents the high-tech industry. You might wonder why I'm here. We are primarily a consortium of companies that make high-tech software and computers and such, though we do have some of our member companies who do issue gift cards, like a whole lot of industries do. In 2007, we wrestled with this right up to almost the very last day of the session, and we instituted some pretty good consumer protection provisions. The bill that we passed in 2007 said you can't have an arbitrary expiration date on a gift card. It said you also can't decline the value over time. Like if you hang on to that card, it can't go from $20 to $10 just because you didn't use it for 6 months or so. And also said there can't be service fees attached. So you can't say if you use the gift card, somehow $1.50 gets deducted from it and you don't get any product. So that was the bill that ultimately did pass in the 2007 legislative session. The one issue I just want to bring to your attention today is this issue of reloadability. My understanding, some retailers, some firms allow you to either reload or sometimes they say in the business, top off your card. I found that a whole lot of our colleagues, for some reason, do this with Starbucks cards, and that's their choice. And Starbucks cards, you can evidently top off or reload. However, there are other companies that have come to my attention that just don't have that built into their system. I mean, it takes a fairly sophisticated computer system to be able to allow a consumer to go on the internet and add value to a card. You have to, it has to connect to the credit card company and all that. So I guess our position would be, and we're not aware that that provision is law in any state. It's been brought out, the cash refund for residual value is law in a few states. We don't know of another state that mandates this reloadability feature of the cards. For some companies, would be a considerable cost to add that because of the software and the data processing and the Visa processing and everything that's involved in making that simple little thing. You go to the internet and say, put 20 more bucks on my card. I think for the companies that do it, it's a great consumer service. It's a consumer's wish to have that, and evidently some do. So we have no problem of that being offered out there for consumers. But for Oregon to mandate this in Oregon only, which are national companies, whether they're retailers or Apple Computer or whatever, we wouldn't support that provision. That's the only piece I wanted to bring here today. You've got two big pieces in this bill. That's the one we're most concerned about. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kramer.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields and members of the committee. Elise Brown here this afternoon representing AT&T in Oregon. And like Jim, AT&T is here to share opposition to Senate Bill 756. AT&T, as you know, is a national carrier across the country, and we provide gift cards across the country. The cards that are purchased through AT&T's network are only purchased at the company-owned retail sites to be used at the company-owned retail sites, kiosks, or online. So as mentioned, the most problematic piece of the bill is the fact that the cards are to be reloadable. And as Jim just stated, we're not familiar with anywhere in the country where that's the case. AT&T's cards are branded as non-reloadable to notify the customer. And if you'll indulge me, I wanted to read what is posted on the back of our card so the customer understands at the point of purchase what is meant by the use of the card. Use of the card constitutes acceptance of the following terms. Purchases will be deducted from the balance of the card until the balance reaches zero. Transactions cannot exceed available funds. The card is not redeemable for cash, and it is non-replenishable. So for our standpoint, again, it doesn't make sense to have a different law, different look here in Oregon, and we would hope that the bill does not move forward as written. Thank you.
Ms. Earls.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries Retail Council and appearing in opposition to Senate Bill 756. We, as with our colleagues, oppose the requirement that the cards be reloadable. As we've already discussed, Oregon would be the only state with this law. And we have some members who are mainly online merchants, and I'm sure many of you have shopped at them, as I have, probably too much. some of those companies have gift cards that are used by the recipient. Mainly, they receive the card, and then they're used to load an online account. So if you go to one major book retailer, you would get a gift certificate or a gift card for Christmas. You'd go to your online account, and you would use the number on the back of that card to reload the amount of money that's available to you in your online account. And that's kind of the end of the gift card at that point, because there's never a physical location where that gift card could be reloaded in order to go back and reload the online account, if you see what I'm saying. If somebody wanted to reload the online account further, they would use their credit card, presumably. Mm-hmm. So that presents one problem for us. The other problem with the bill is, and it's equally problematic, is that this bill would require that the gift card be redeemable for cash when the value drops below $10. Most of our retailers place the value of cutting a return check to a customer at between $30 and $35. So what you're asking retailers to do, and in particular online retailers, is to cut a check that costs them $30 or $35 in order to reimburse a customer for $10. To us, that seems unfair and an unwarranted demand on retailers, and we oppose both portions of the bill, I would say, equally.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Senator Boquist.
Oh, I can't let AT&T get away either. What size font is on that card you just read to us, please?
Chair Shields, Senator Boquist. I don't know, but lucky I have my big glasses. I probably could read it for you if it was sitting in front of me. I apologize. I don't know the size of the font.
Pretty small, though, isn't it? Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sean Miller and panel. Jarvis Gardner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association, and just want to share some concerns regarding Senate Bill 756 with the committee. And Representative Jefferson Smith offered, or at least outlined, kind of what our grocery stores do when you talk about the turnstile, where we actually sell a lot more than just a Fred Meyer card or Safeway card. We actually sell pretty much everybody's card in our stores. The reason why we do that is because it's convenient. It's the reason why it's in the front of the store. A lot of people like to buy these gift cards, and so it's a we view it as selling these to consumers because people actually want them to give out. I do want to talk about section 1, sub 4, sub 5, where it talks about the refilling the cards, and the way the language and the way the bill reads now currently is that we will not be able to sell a gift card unless we can actually refill it. It doesn't actually distinguish, and I think that was to Senator Bonamici's question on the $10. There actually is nothing in here that would not require us to actually be able to, refill that particular card that we sell. And so we sell, everything from Starbucks to anything, any retail merchant available and at our stores. And so that particular language would say that unless we can actually refill it, which is a problem, we activate the cards. And so if you come in and buy a Home Depot $20 card, we'll activate that card, but it's impractical to access to try to actually refill the Home Depot card. And so we have some concerns there. I do want to also distinguish the difference between what some merchants are doing now, which is, I think, a good marketing tactic currently, which are distinguishing the difference between a customer loyalty cards versus an actual gift card. Because, and I'll use Starbucks as the example, there is merchants out there that are using these cards where people can refill them currently. And they do that. They may get discounts. They may get free coffee. It's a good benefit to them to offer these. But in a gift card, you're actually buying it and you're giving it to someone else. And when you give it to someone else, the likelihood, and again, the practical likelihood of them actually refilling their own card after you've given to them is I guess highly unlikely. Why would you actually want to refill your own card when you can just use your debit card? Again, you're giving a company the float of your money versus having the money in your own bank account. And so there is a difference from a consumer standpoint that I want the committee to look at on the difference between, again, I think, which is good for consumers, these customer loyalty cards, where if people want to actually refill them, they can, and it's a benefit to the consumer. But the likelihood of somebody doing that after you receive a gift to refill your own card to use, I think is we don't see that really as from a practical standpoint, really actually going to happen. With that said, Mr. Chair, I'll leave my concerns to those and happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Jarvis.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, Evan Jarvis of Oxley & Associates, appearing before you today on behalf of Fred Meyer, Safeway, and Rite Aid. I would like to echo the comments made by Mr. Miller and add just a few things of particular concern to our clients, the first of which is the requirement that gift cards are reloadable. The ability to reload a gift card requires special software, and that software is costly to implement, and at this time of the economy, it would be particularly costly to businesses. No other state mandates that cards are reloadable. The second provision that's problematic is that cashback must be offered on cards with a balance of $10 or less. Offering that cashback takes away incentives for our retailers to offer gift cards, because we offer our cards in order to bring consumers into the stores and purchase our goods and services, and we're not in the business of transacting cash exchanges. Finally, the proponents of this bill have testified that it was brought forward to address environmental concerns and litter concerns, and what our clients believe that we should be good stewards of the environment, but think that there are other pieces of legislation in this building that better address those concerns, such as the plastic bag ban, for example. So with that, I urge you not to proceed with Senate Bill 756, and with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Craven.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for Walmart. Ms. Earls testified about the cashback provision and the transactional cost of cutting a check back for a refund that, under her example, would exceed by roughly 350% the amount of the cashback required cashback rebate. There's another cost I simply want to draw the committee's attention to. I'll use an example of a $20 gift certificate used once for a $10 purchase, and then with $10 remaining on it. If you are required to give the cash back of $10, you have, and assuming that gift card was purchased with a Visa or a MasterCard, you have in effect doubled the merchant charge on the initial purchase, because you have charged against the full $20 value, but have really only gotten the merchandising benefit of $10 of it. And that, over the long term, that simply hurts our ability to keep prices low.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you. I guess I'll pick on Walmart this time around because it's the largest carrier. Walmart has more super computing power than the Department of Defense does. It has probably the finest automated logistics system in the world, bar none. It can track probably the cockroaches in the back room and get things done. So what I'm hearing you say is Walmart, who has a good reputation with these cards, can't track it. But the real question is, as you brought out marketing costs here, what is the cost typically in the industry of unutilized cards? And what I mean there is people go out and buy a gift card for $50. They can't use it because they can't buy anything less than some of these stores for less than $10, we'll say hypothetically. I think that number is too high. Five is maybe more realistic. But then what does the industry stick in their pocket? Because this all goes into the marketing cost here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, I don't know the answer to that question, but I'd be delighted to try to find out.
In this follow-up, I think Fred Meyer, which is a chain of deals. I mean, it would be very interesting to know in this industry how much of this money goes unclaimed, basically, as part of their marketing effort, and they stick in their pocket. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, Sean Miller again on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association. We'll look into that answer for you. But I do, to an earlier question you had regarding the open cards versus the closed cards, you had mentioned MasterCard Visa. You can't actually go out and buy a open gift card with those companies. Those aren't under the current law. That's an open card versus a closed card, for instance, where you actually buy it and it's, you know, a particular store's card. So I just want to distinguish between the two.
And I'm sympathetic to the issue of clarifying, you know, who the retailer is doing. But at some point, Walmart's easy to pick on, and I know they're picking on Walmart because they do a pretty good, better job than most other retailers. But the issue comes down to is Walmart's able to track it and figure out what's going on in those cards, and many of these other industries can't. Whereas the Visa card, which you can get from the credit unions. In fact, the credit unions here in Oregon, you can get an open Visa card and just keep reloading it. Mm-hmm. So,
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Yes,
briefly, Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, and our cards, I believe, are reloadable. So that's not really the issue for us. It's the transactional costs that are associated with essentially upfront charges to finance the purchase of the Visa merchant card charge, and then not getting the benefit of that deal.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, that's why I was wanting to know what the unused portion is, so you do a cash benefit analysis.
Yeah, no, I think that would be useful information for the committee. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like some clarification, whether it be from anyone who's testified in support or in opposition of the issue, which I thought was clear from the prior testimony about who gives the refund. Josh did a really good job of explaining that this bill doesn't apply to the Visa-type card, and that's not in the bill, but it's in the definition of gift card that's in the existing statute. But I would really like clarification on that, because it sounds like from this panel that it would be the grocery store giving the refund, but it sounds like the testimony was if you buy a Starbucks or a Gap card at Safeway, you go to Starbucks or the Gap to get the refund. So if we could get that clarified, I'd appreciate that, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, if I could comment just real briefly on that. I guess that's unclear in the bill is what we're raising the issue, because it does say that a person may not sell a gift card unless it's, again, refillable, or then you redeem the cash under $10 value. So it's not specific onto the store. And so under this, since, again, Fred Meyer, I'll use them as an example, would be selling the actual gift card for another company, it's not clear in the bill that they would not be able to make these requirements. And if they don't, they would not be able to sell it.
Okay, that's right.
Understood.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, Josh, you have attracted some attention, and I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. We'll press ahead and see where this ends up. Thank you very much for bringing this forward, and we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 756, and we will return to, I will reopen a public hearing on Senate Bill 85. And could we please bring up Don Miner, Dale Strom, and Chuck Carpenter, please? Welcome to the committee, gentlemen.
Thank
Sorry,
you.
I appreciate your patience.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. I want to begin by saying that the manufactured housing industry is a very responsible industry. And to the extent that consumers have been injured, it's regrettable. Don't make any excuses, but I will say that consumers who make deposits with merchants, and if that merchant goes out of business, they're an unsecured creditor, so that's nothing unique to this industry. And just a point of clarification, Mr. Tapman said that they'd received 6 complaints in the last 3 years. I don't believe that he just said that consumers have lost money in 6 businesses in the last year. I think it was 1. It was substantial, though, and so I don't mean to minimize it, but I just wanted to make sure that the committee has an idea of how that works. As was pointed out, the bill does 3 things. It requires that dealers place deposits of money in either an escrow or a trust account. That's a piece of the legislation that our industry does not support. It restricts access to the dealer bonds solely to consumers. That is a piece that we're supportive of. And streamlines the regulatory process that the agency can use to enforce the statutes, and we also support that. We've worked with Mr. Tapman for a considerable period, and he's worked hard to bridge the differences on this bill, and we greatly appreciate it, particularly fixing the fiduciary piece. Dealers were surprised that they might owe a fiduciary duty to a consumer. Lawyers may owe a fiduciary duty, but generally merchants owe a duty of good faith, fair dealing, and that's fixed in the Dash 3. But even with the Dash 3 amendments, we can't support the provisions of the bill dealing with the trusts and escrow. Would just give you a flavor for how this industry is regulated. It's one of the most heavily regulated industries in the state, probably all out of proportion to what's justified, but just layers and layers. Just a brief flavor. I won't go into much detail. They're regulated by the Department of Housing and Urban Development. They have to report regularly to those folks. HUD requires that they provide a warning that when you buy a manufactured home, that the air inside that home may be hazardous to your health. Yet HUD has gone to great lengths to regulate that air is at least as healthy as the outside air. If they carry a contract, they have to meet the new licensing requirements adopted by Congress and this legislature under the SAFE Act, which is additional bonding, additional insurance, continuing education. They're also regulated by the Oregon Building Codes Division, which requires that they provide disclosures and reports to the state and participate in the dispute resolution process, where if a person who installed a home that was arranged for by the dealer doesn't fix it, the dealer is required to fix it or go out of business. They're regulated as construction contractors by the CCB. They're required to meet every requirement than a home builder is required to meet, including the continuing education, the insurance, and providing the bond and participate again in that consumer dispute resolution process. As Mr. Tapman pointed out, they're regulated by the banking division or the Department of Finance and Corporate Securities, where they're required to have another $40,000 bond, which is not required of builders, I might point out. In addition to that, they're subject to civil penalties of $5,000 per offense for every violation of administrative rules by the DFCS, as well as criminal prosecutions. The Department of Justice regulates the contents of their purchase agreement in great detail, far more than is, well, unlike anything that's done for the building industry. The Uniform Commercial Code provides that if a consumer buys a home from a manufactured home dealer, and that dealer's the home is on his lot, and that dealer doesn't pay lien holders, banks, others that might have a security interest in it, nevertheless, that consumer gets that home free and clear of those. Now, that's unlike if you have a remodeler come out and work on your home. He doesn't pay his lien holders. The consumer, even though he's paid that builder, can be required to pay again. This legislature decided not to fix that problem last session. At least that's my recollection. The industry sees the requirement that deposits be held in escrow or trust, so just more paperwork, more reporting, and more government intrusion into the industry. They also question why other merchants wouldn't be subject to similar requirements. Home builders, remodelers, RV dealers, car dealers. And I will point out that RVs can cost far more than a manufactured home.
Are you suggesting an amendment, Don?
Well, that's probably where this comes out, actually. Because it seems like, from our point of view, if this is good public policy, why wouldn't there be a requirement that all merchants who take deposits hold them in escrow or trust? And you might not want to deal with a person who sells a washing machine or a gift card, although if the merchant that sold the gift card goes out of business, I assume that everyone that bought a gift card there is an unsecured creditor, and while it might on individual basis be a small sum, in the aggregate that could be a large sum of money. But you might, if it's good public policy, why not a requirement that every merchant who takes a deposit larger than X hold that deposit in trust or escrow, so that if that business fails, that they'll be protected. If I could move from that, we do not oppose the requirement restricting access to the dealer bond. One member has pointed out, though, that if the green eye shade corporate folks were to see that, they might see that as less protection for themselves and might require that the manufactured home retailer provide additional security. But with that provision, then, a consumer purchasing a manufactured home or dealing with a manufactured home retailer would have access to the $40,000 dealer bond and the $20,000 contractor bond. In addition, the final portion of the bill, Section 11, provides more administrative authority for the agency to enforce its rules. We support that. We think it's good public policy. Finally, I'd just say that if the committee wants to go forward with the bill as is, that at least there be some more time provided for the industry to comply. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you very much. Let's continue on with the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Chuck Carpenter, Executive Director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. We represent about 500 manufactured home communities here in the state of Oregon. We are opposed to Senate Bill 85, and unlike Don's situation, we represent the landlords, the people who own manufactured home communities. We don't want to usually be dealers, but what has happened to us over the last 10 years is as we've gone through our own
housing crisis in the manufactured housing industry. Increasingly in the last 10, 15 years, landlords, community owners have had to, when a home becomes abandoned in a manufactured home community, the only way that home sometime is going to be rehabilitated and sold is if the community owner takes possession of the home and then goes through the process of marketing it, repairing it, and then offering it for sale again. And I have Dale Strom here to talk about some of the challenges he's faced as he's gone through that process. But ORS 90.675 outlines specifically the rights and responsibilities of that community owner as he or she goes through that process of acquiring that home and then turning around and offering it for sale and getting reimbursed. Quite often now what we see happening is that these homes become very run down. The landlord, the community owner, will go through and renovate it. And as Dale will talk, these homes, although may be sold for $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, but it still is at a substantial loss to the community owner. But the community owner looks at this and says, well, I may take a $10,000 loss on this home, but downstream, if I keep this home in the community and I'm able to get somebody to move in and rent the property, then I'll eventually be able to recoup my loss. But we just feel that this bill adds another layer of red tape onto the manufactured housing community industry. We feel that there are some protections out there for us, and there is a sort of reputation, or in the past, manufactured home communities have been given things like a limited dealer's license. As we went through this crisis in the 90s, and now that gave some sort of benefits or rights to community owners to be able to be dealers, but on a very limited capacity. And I think that's what we would like to continue, is that we be exempt from some of these issues, because these are usually handshake agreements. Dale can talk a little bit more about that. Then finally, I'd just like to say that this is the type of issue is that I feel that the landlord, manufactured housing landlord tenant coalition, is ideally suited to deal with. This issue has not been brought before our group. It's a group of industry representatives. Don is involved in it. Dale has been involved in it. Senator Bonamici has said in some of our meetings. Ideally, we've come up with some really good solutions to our challenges. I've been on that committee for the last 12 years. This has not been an issue that has ever been raised by resident advocates but not heard any complaints from folks complaining about landlords who shortchanged them in the sale of the home. Now, there's other complaints, plenty of other complaints that landlords get tagged with, but this is not one of them. So I'm not sure what the problem is we're trying to solve here. And as I said, if there is a problem, this is the sort of thing that the coalition really should work on. And like Don, I'd like to have more time for us to go back and take a look at this issue and see if there is an acceptable remedy that we can come up with. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. My name is Dale Strom. I am a board member of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, which Chuck is our executive director. I am also the owner of Riverbend Manufactured Home Park. It's located in Clatskanie. And I'm also a tenant in common for Country Manor Mobile Home Park in Springfield. Riverbend is a 39-space park in Clatskanie. Country Manor is a 133-space park in Springfield. My father was the one that purchased the Country Manor back in the early 70s. I want to say it was either 72 or 73. The other tenants in that park are my siblings. It is a family-run park, so to speak, and we have been running the park actively, very actively, since we have taken over the park. Chuck asked me to come here and speak with you today because from an owner standpoint, from a landlord standpoint, I can tell you what it's been like to operate a park, and I'm primarily talking about my park in Clatskanie, the 39-space park. I do own a limited dealer's license, as was mentioned, and during that time, the park that I bought. It was in September in 2006. There was a home that was part of the park, part of the sale that I purchased, that was occupied by a tenant at the time. Since that time, I have come in to ownership of three other homes, and I just wanted to let you know what I had to do in order to get it, my thinking behind bringing in these homes to vacant spaces within my park, and the reasons why I wanted to sell it, and the expenses that I had to go through in order to get it. In none of these homes did I make any money at all. In fact, I took substantial losses at least on two of the homes. I have a handout that I think that has been distributed to you. And I wanted to talk about there were the two homes that I purchased that I brought in. One came from Forest Grove that I purchased in May 2009 at a cost of $15,500. Another home that I bought was in Bend. I bought in August of 2010. I bought it for $8,500. The transportation to get the homes to my park, again, the one from Forest Grove was a little less than $6,000, where the home from Bend was about $8,000. The difference there being the distance it was from Forest Grove to Clatskanie versus the distance from Bend to Clatskanie, the transportation cost being a little bit different. I am noting here that both of those homes were double-wide homes. In order for me to bring these homes in, I need to go to the city of Clatskanie, and I need to ask and purchase a permit from them in order to purchase it. And included in that are fees for setup, step and skirting, plumbing, and electrical permits. And then I wanted to put on top of that, there is a 9.5% surcharge from the state of Oregon in order for me to get the fees for the setup, skirting, plumbing, and electric. Another thing that I wanted to let you know, the geography of my park. It is located on the Clatskanie River. Okay, that and where the river is at that point is roughly around 10 feet in elevation because it is within 5 miles of the Columbia River. My park, the land is approximately 14 feet in elevation, and according to FEMA, the flood, 100-year flood zone is 16 feet, and according to the recent regulations, Don, you may want to correct me if I'm wrong, it has to be 18 inches above that 100-year floodplain, so the threshold of my homes have to be 17.5 feet in elevation because of the possibilities of flooding that may occur. The surveys, I have to have a pre- and post-survey that verifies that my homes are 17.5 feet high before they're put in, and then once they're installed with tie-downs and everything else, that, again, I need to certify that they're 17.5 feet. Part of the red tape that I think we're talking about that this Senate bill will do is kind of piling on from why do I need a pre- and post-survey? Well, it cost me a lot of money. It cost me about $500 per survey, and I have to go through the entire survey both times. Just a couple other things that I do, site preparation. I go through a local...
Dale, can I interrupt you real quick? I think we get the big point is that you've got a lot of regulation that you already have to deal with.
Okay.
That's what you're getting at, right?
Okay.
And I don't mean to cut you off. It's just that we have a couple of other bills. Can you help me? I do want to ask you a question, though. On this one where you would have to set up the additional account, can you help me understand what that would mean to your everyday business and how that would impact you?
Well, first of all, I bank at Bank of America, and I ask them, what kind of account do we need? Do I need to open up a brand new account? Do I have to set up a special trust account or whatever else? I would also need to purchase some checks to write to and from whoever my debtors are, and you know, and also The other thing is that documenting the expenses, where I bring them in, where the money comes in, where the money flows to, and that sort of thing. The documentation. What kind of documentation are you looking for? Are you looking for just a general ledger account, or are you looking for something that is that I could post on my check register? That sort of a thing. It's one of those things where I don't see that there would be much use for me to keep it active. If I only sell four homes a year, the three homes that I sold this past year, I sold for cash. Okay, because of that, I took in cash. I on the same day, I would go to St. Helens, the county seat of Columbia County, and I would make the change in of the registration to that, where it would come down here to Salem. Would this be a case where I would need to take the sales price, the funds for the sale, put it into that account, and then I would move it over to my regular bank account? I mean, there's a lot of things that are up in the air as far as I'm concerned as an owner, how I would operate this sort of a thing.
Okay, that's great. That's good information for us to have. I really do appreciate you coming. Any questions? Senator Boquist?
Don, could you go back, if you just recollect here, I don't know, an hour ago, PCBS was up here. They were talking about the Dash 3s and what their attempt to change in the Dash 3s so that when someone went to a dealer, not your manufacturers, but went to a dealer, one of these 256 dealers, and the consumer placed a deposit down for a manufactured home, which they would then put on an order from one of your companies you represent, they talked about that they would be able to take those funds and go back to one of the, I know there's not 10 manufacturers, we're down to more like 6 now.
Yeah,
okay,
getting there.
Okay, so I do know that, because they're in my district, as you know. They would be able to, the dealer would then be able to make a payment onward to the manufacturer, which of course would help the manufacturer to cash flow the house. Is that this one of the sort of changes you're talking about? I mean, the money's, what the amendment he's talking about seems to be not freezing the money, but what the problem here is, I think everybody realizes, is it's that we have some dealers who are not manufacturers, and they're not gentlemen like these who own them, but who are just brokers, basically salesmen, and they take that money in and put it in escrow. But what he's saying in that amendment is that money would then go on to the manufacturer. So how does that impact you in terms of the Dash 3? Because all your testimony was about the Dash 2, or the original bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, first of all, our association represents both manufacturers and retailers. The initial bill required that the dealer leave the money in trust or escrow until the transaction was completed, essentially. The Dash 2 amendments allow the money to be spent in further or in pursuant to the contract to carry out the contract. They're not just brokers, actually. The dealer has homes on his lot. He's the owner of those. That's his inventory. He's paid for them. Those are his goods. Now, he may have borrowed the money from someone to pay for them. But I will say that the Dash 2 amendments made the bill tolerable. Well, that piece was in the Dash 2, I believe. The Dash 3 dealt with the issue of whether or not manufactured homes owed a fiduciary duty to their consumer. In addition, there was a conflict in the Dash 2s where in one place it said that the money was required to remain in escrow or trust until the home was delivered or the transaction terminated. And in another provision in the amendments said that the dealer could use them pursuant to the contract. So Dash 3 also corrects that. But the Dash 3s actually incorporate all of the Dash 2s as well and make those two additional corrections.
All right.
Was that
great, gentlemen. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
I think we have a pretty good sense of, you know, what we as a committee need to wrestle here. David, I'm willing to give you a minute or two if you want to respond to anything. But if you could do us a favor and keep it brief, we'll need to move on.
Again, for the record, this is David Tapman. I got an appreciation and sense that the panel seems to get the issue, and so I don't want to belabor that much longer. I do want to identify, though, one of the things that Senator Boquist brought up, 256 versus 10 overall manufacturers, 6 in Oregon, are a big difference, and not all of them are connected. And there are problems, as we mentioned, and we've had people lose money, and we've had people, through the goodness of other people's hearts, manufacturers in most cases, get their money back indirectly. That is primarily why we want to correct that. The issues that we heard from the last two witnesses really go to a separate issue. This is not an issue of landlord-tenant. We're not talking about that. We're talking about seller and buyer, and that's a whole different relationship. And so with all due respect to what you heard, and I don't mean to diminish the amount of money they're spending, but that's not the issue, and it doesn't need to go before a landlord-tenant organization. The issue is one of consumer protection on behalf of people who are at a disadvantage dealing with others when they give their money up. And I think the Dash 3s went a long way to try and address Mr. Miner's concerns, and as he said, it's, quote, now tolerable, and I think it achieves what we hope it would do and would work well to protect consumers without harming the industry. So thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. I do think we need to plow ahead on this. I'm not going to move it today, but there does seem to be the sense of the committee that it would make sense to do something here, and so if the parties could keep working at that, I would greatly appreciate it, and we do appreciate you coming to give your testimony on this. It doesn't seem like the two parties are that far apart, and if we can get to yes, I would like to do so.
Dash 4.
So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 85, and I'm going to, since Director Koba is here, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 118, and as I mentioned before, we're going to then jump in as best we can into Senate, actually instead of what I said before, jump into Senate Bill 490 to make sure that has enough time, and we may need to roll over Senate Bill 628 if we don't get far enough.
They're growing grass back there. Ag department's been here so long.
You could just My apologies.
I knew that was going to come up. Mr. Chair and members, good afternoon. I'm Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture here before you on Senate Bill 118. And I'm going to be very brief in lieu of the committee's time, but certainly if there's questions, you know, you kind of give me a sense of where you've got questions. I think all of you are familiar with the bill. So Senate Bill 118 deals with funding our food safety program, and we do have Dash 1 amendments for you that we would recommend move forward. Our food safety program is funded with a mixture of general fund and other fund. And our fee mechanism on the other fund is annual license fees. I think Senator George actually pays an annual license fee, so he probably has a lot of opinion about this. Beginning in 2005 and working with the fee payers for our program, it was put into statute that we would have a mandatory 2% per year increase for the food safety program. That increase sunsetted in 2010. So before you have a mechanism to put in place a May 3% a year increase. So it moves from being a shall 2% to a May 3%. And the reason that we're doing this is it gives the department a little bit more flexibility in terms of managing our ending fund balance. We're not building up ending fund cash balances that we don't need. If we don't need a fee increase in any given year, we would not have to put one in place. So the fee increase mechanism would happen by administrative rule, which is actually the way we set our fees prior to 2005. I think that you will hear today support for this concept, and I've also distributed to the committee a letter to clarify for you, and this is something that we've clarified with our fee payers based on our current revenue projections for the 11-13 biennium. Barring some unforeseen circumstance, we would not need to raise fees in the 11-13 biennium. So in essence, if this bill moves forward and it's put in place, our projections right now is that we would have to raise
fees beginning the process in the spring of 2013 for renewals that begin July 1 of 2013. So I wanted to clarify that for the record. The Dash 1 amendments take out a provision that we had initially put in the bill that would allow cost recovery for some of the technical services that we provide in visiting with our fee payers. They did not want to go in that direction, so we're fine with that. So the Dash 1 amendments take out the cost recovery component. Was there anything else in the Dash 1s?
Emergency class
days. Oh, the sunset, excuse me. So this up to 3% does sunset in 2018, allows us to come back and revisit this with our fee payers.
And it's your intention that this go to Ways and Means to be part of your budget?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Question, Senator George.
Colleagues, those of you may know that I own a food processing company, and I want to kind of put this in context. After 9/11, the federal government funded a very aggressive epidemiology effort to deal with such things as anthrax and those types of things. And that was done through the FDA and through the state departments of agriculture. And what that's done is created a situation where the science has now gone far ahead of what food processors generally have been used to. And so what has happened is the FDA has, under the new Modernization Act, has a huge amount of regulatory authority, and the science is far ahead of what the industry is used to dealing with. And our only ally in this to try to bring us up to speed is the Department of Agriculture here in the state. So if we have a question as food processors, we can't go to the FDA. They won't give us an answer. Literally, that they just are simply a regulatory agency. The only place we have to go for assistance in dealing with these technological advances is the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And as you all know, I rarely vote for fee increases, but I will tell you that as somebody who pays this, we truly are behind the eight ball all the time on the science, simply because of the fact that the federal government is spending so much money developing this, and they're not sharing that with food processors around the country. And so Katie's team has been amazingly supportive of all of our industries, and it is vital in those of us who are in this business bringing all of our standards to the highest levels possible. And so I just want to stress that this is really necessary for us because we're in a constantly changing environment, especially over the last 10 years, and basically our only island of support is really Katie's department, and so this fee is desperately needed for us to be able to have that, continue that support. So I just want to make sure I express to you the desperate situation a lot of us are in dealing with this, and how much we appreciate the department. And I know this is a fee increase, but that's one of the reasons why I'm strongly supportive.
Good comments. Thank you. All right. Additional questions?
You're talking to me, Dave.
The amendment that we're moving is... Oh, yes. Sean Miller, please. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association in support of the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 118. We have been working with the department since the interim on this particular bill and are very supportive of the agency. They have done a great job, and we do support a fully funded food safety division. I will say that, you know, the bill is necessary because we have, and I know I'm not talking to a Ways and Means subcommittee, although I know some of the members serve on Ways and Means, but we have had money in this particular fund taken out and spent on other things, and so this gives the agency the ability to manage that ending balance by looking at by rule what the fee increase should be each year. We do appreciate the director's the administrator's ability, and they're not going to be raising fees in the next 2 years under what they currently have, but the five-year sunset also gives us ability to look at how that was managed to make sure we can keep the program fully funded and necessary while not making a too big of an ending balance that is becomes a target in this building. So with that, Mr. Chair, happy to answer your questions.
Okay. Senator George.
We have a work session.
Oh, yeah. So I could need a good vice chair. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 118. Okay, because we don't. Okay. So, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 118.
Patrick just informed me we don't have all the paperwork to move the bill, but we can at least adopt the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 18-1 amendments to Senate Bill 118, dated 2/25/11.
Senator George has moved the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 118. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 118 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 490. Patrick.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 490. We had one brief bit of a testimony on this last Wednesday. This bill requires utilities providing natural or liquid gas, propane, gas, electricity, or water service to notify resident tenants possible termination of utility or service that is paid for by the landlord. Allows tenants to retain utility services of up to the lesser of 3 billing periods or 90 days by paying the current amount due. You have a -3 amendment on this one that's in your packet, but we do not currently have any paperwork besides the -3 amendment. And I believe the proponents of the measure will be speaking to the bill with the amendment, Mr. Chair.
All right. Sybil Hebb.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today to speak in favor of Senate Bill 490. I will preface my remarks by indicating that I will be speaking to the bill with the -3 amendments. We have other issues or concerns that have come up after the -3 amendments, and I'll talk to you about those as well. The Law Center, as you know, provides access to justice for low-income Oregonians. A significant percentage of our clients, the majority of our clients, are tenants, do not own their homes, but rent their homes. Some of those tenants, and an increasing number that we have seen over the past couple of years, are in rental agreements through which they pay a lump sum to their landlord, and the landlord provides the utility service to the tenant. So the tenant, him or herself, doesn't have an independent relationship with the utility service provider. They get that service through their landlord, and they pay for that by paying their landlord in rent. They're therefore dependent on the landlord for the provision of that service, and if the landlord becomes delinquent in the payments to the utility provider, the tenant bears the burden of that delinquency by suffering the shutoff of the utility service. And that's the scenario that has started to come into our offices more regularly and which has caused us concern in the past couple of years. And the impact to a low-income tenant when utility service is shut off is significant. When that happens without any notice, the impact is devastating. And under current Oregon law, there is no structure or no provision by which those tenants get a consistent amount of notice in those circumstances prior to shutoff. Utility companies that are regulated by the PUC, the investor-owned utilities, do have a set of rules that address this situation by requiring the provision of a 5-day notice to the tenant prior to shutoff of services. No other utility companies are regulated by the PUC, and there is no state law that speaks to the issue. While we agree with some of the objectors to the bill that the circumstances in which tenants suffer a shutoff are not numerous, we have seen cases where it has happened and the impact is devastating. The cases that we've seen have been from across the state. You heard when the hearing was briefly opened last week an example from Central Oregon in which person with disabilities was a tenant in Lapine and suffered the shutoff of electric service without any notice at his mobile home in Lapine, and in the middle of winter suffered an extremely negative impact. He lost his sewer pump, he lost his water, he lost his ability to heat because the heat to the unit was supplied through electricity, he lost his ability to cook. And so this person in an isolated rural area was forced to figure out how to manage that, and as a person with some slight cognitive disabilities, he was significantly challenged in managing to deal with that stress. We've also, at the Oregon Law Center, had examples of cases in Grants Pass, as well as Portland and Malala and Pendleton. I've provided in my testimony, and I'll describe briefly, two specific examples to give you an idea of what happens, and those examples come from Eastern Oregon as well as Southern Oregon. We also have attached to my testimony letters of support from allies allied community organizations who see this in their populations, and that those include the Housing Alliance, the Urban League, Innovative Changes, Community Action Partnership, 211 Info, and Malala Communities That Care. I'll just talk briefly now about two examples that I want to draw your attention to. The first took place in Eastern Oregon. And there's a letter attached from the director of our Ontario Legal Aid Office. In that scenario, the attorney, our office, got a call at 2:30 in the afternoon on a Friday indicating that service was had been shut off and there was no power. And this was a winter day, it was snowing, and there were 10 to 15 tenant families in that that apartment building that were facing this circumstance. Our office was able to intervene in that circumstance and get the power restored prior to the weekend, which was an exceptional success for everybody involved. But had there not been that access to our office late in the afternoon on a Friday, all of these families would have been in significant trouble over the weekend. Just briefly, one more example comes from Southern Oregon and an additional letter from our Coos Bay office attorney who handled a call. This call came from, significantly, the manager of a mobile home park. That manager had received a call from the owner of the park. The owner lived in California, had become delinquent on the payments. The owner got a call from the utility provider indicating that service was going to be cut off within 24 hours. The owner happened to call the manager with the instructions to evict everybody on short notice. That manager had the decency to have concerns and to call our office. We were able to get involved and to take care of the situation. But had those two things not happened, this was an entire park, 26 families, who would have been shut off of their electric service. And again, as maybe is common with manufactured home parks, electricity is one of the most important services. And again, these tenants were dependent on that service provider for their heat, their water pump, their refrigeration, their cooking ability, and more. And of significant note in this particular park, more than half of the tenants were people who were either seniors or people with disabilities and had medication and other issues that they were concerned about. So, again, the numbers of times when this happens is not huge, and we believe that utility providers are good business owners and they do their best to try to prevent this situation, but there's not consistency across the state, there's not a state statute on point, and there are people who suffer greatly when this goes wrong. And it's our goal as the Law Center to speak up for those people who can't be here today and to try to move this discussion forward in a way that can provide some consistent protection across the state in both urban and rural communities where we're talking about essential utility services such as gas, water, and electricity. I'll briefly describe the Dash 3 amendments. They were, and I should say I appreciate that the utility providers have sat down with us a number of different times, and so we've gotten a lot of feedback. The Dash 3 amendments were drafted after getting some feedback. They do not have the agreement of all of the parties, but the Dash 3 amendments, by any chance, but the Dash 3 amendments provide that utilities would give 15 days advance notice to tenants in these circumstances to allow them time to either make a payment to the utility so as to maintain service without interruption or find some help and take steps to address the concern with their landlord. Those amendments have continued to get concerns and opposition expressed. After much input, we have expressed that we would be willing to further negotiate and focus on the most important key piece here, which is notice to tenants, so that they're not coming home in the middle of the night with their families to find no service. And so we've offered to provide that any non-PUC-regulated utility have a statutory provision to give them 5 days' notice prior to losing service. We've taken out, or we've offered to take out the piece that would require the utility to accept a payment from the tenant so that they don't have to take different payments from different people, and just focused on making sure that there is a 5-day notice prior to shutoff and that that notice provides some information to the tenant about where they can go to get help, where they can call with questions.
Senator Monroe?
5 business days or calendar days?
5 business days is what our contemplation was. Senator Monroe, sorry, Senator Shields. So we've offered to make concessions that would specifically focus just on the notice. That's the piece that is the most of the most vital importance, and then at least if we're providing tenants with information about where they can get assistance, we have the ability, or other community service agencies in the community have the ability, to try to intervene and find a solution that works for everybody. I would make it clear that in the cases in which we have been contacted, there are not, to my knowledge, lawsuits that have come out of that. It's been the ability of our office caring about this population to say, here, how can we come to a common solution? And utility providers, when they have been contacted in those circumstances, have found a way to make things work. And so we're not presenting this as a way to try to call people bad actors, but rather to suggest that our state structures and our practices around utilities and the provision of services have all focused on the provision of service to customers. And that's of great value, and we appreciate the rules and the policies that are in place around that. But this is a population, tenants who are dependent upon the customer, the landlord, for the provision of service. They're not addressed, and they are suffering. And so that's why we're continuing to have this discussion and why we really hope that we can find a way to move forward. In discussions with the utility providers, we have heard feedback that they do, in fact, have policies and guidance for themselves around how they manage this in any given community, and we appreciate that that is probably very much the case. But unfortunately, what we've seen is circumstances where those policies have not worked and tenants have suffered, and we think that it's to the state's public policy benefit and the benefit of low-income communities that there is a state standard minimum amount of notice that is provided to people prior to losing such essential service. The only other thing that I would mention before I close is that there is, of important note, a federal district court case on this issue. I cited in my testimony, and it's called Turpin versus the City of Corvallis. And that case addressed a scenario like this in which a tenant was dependent upon the landlord to make provisions, payments to the utility, and that landlord became delinquent, and the utility shut service off to the tenants. And in that circumstance, the court found that where there are publicly owned utilities, there is a matter of such great significance that there is, in effect, a due process right to those tenants to get notice prior to the shutoff of such an essential service. And so we think that here today we're before you with a court case that says this is an important issue. We've got examples that show that the lack of service, the shutoff of service without notice, has devastating impacts, especially on low-income people who may not be able to go to a hotel in the middle of the night on short notice, who can't. And for those reasons, we're here to say that we'd like the state to establish a minimum amount of notice. We think it's the right thing to do, and we think that there's a way for us to make this work. So. Okay. Thank you.
One question, and then I want to get some opponents.
I just have a clarification question on the dash 3, I guess. I'm looking at the notice portion. What would constitute notice? Certified letter, or is it physical delivery 200 miles away?
At Chair Shields, members of the committee, Senator Boquist, under the dash 3s, and we have offered to reduce this in our discussions, but the most important concept for us is that notice get posted on the door. Utilities are doing that for their customers already as a matter of practice, and we would like to make sure that that happens at the service address where the tenant is living. And we have proposed that there be some standard language, and it doesn't need to be long. And the standardization that we propose is only to make it easier for folks, that basically says, here's when your service is threatened to be shut off. This is the date, and hopefully that would be 5 days from the posting of the notice. And here's some information about where you can go to get help. Dash 3s provide, and we would advocate that this be continued, that the notice be posted on every individual door. In multifamily places, that can sometimes be difficult, and so we would agree that there should be a provision that says if you can't get in, post it on the entrance. And that's our concept.
30-second follow-up. I think you're sure. And it applies to all utilities in the state, correct?
Senator Shields, Chair Shields, Senator Boquist, the dash 3s apply to all. We have, because the utilities that are investor-owned and regulated by PUC, they already have a rule that requires them to provide 5 days' notice. They have agreed to put this issue on their docket for further discussion, and we have accepted that proposal, and the PUC has also indicated that they're willing to do that for further discussion, and so our our concept would be in an amendment that the statute that we propose would bring the other utilities up to the 5-day minimum standard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms.
Thank you.
I think we're only going to have time for two people, unfortunately, in opposition. So can we bring up Paul Romaine and Ted Case? And unfortunately, those of you who've waited this long time, we're going to have to roll it over.
Yeah, sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland and part of the Romaine Group, and we represent the Oregon People's Utility Districts Association. We are 5 of the 6 people utility districts who are in rural parts of the state, and we, sort of like you, are elected boards. We are our own PUCs, if you would. People elect people to, in effect, run the electric company. We have to stand for election. We're not regulated necessarily by the PUC. This bill, while well-meaning, is sort of a solution in search of a problem, at least in our areas. We don't know about other areas of the state. There's been no examples of anything in our areas where there's ever been a shutoff. We just don't do that. We go out, because we are elected boards, we go out and work with people. We write off minuscule amounts for unpaid electric bills. We have unique problems. Tillamook PUD, 80% of the places that they serve with electricity we don't send the bill to that address. It's usually to a P.O. box or someplace. So what each individual utility does is set up their own way of dealing with the problem. We are municipal corporations, so we are subject to that case that was referred to in earlier testimony. So the idea of providing notice, due process, is already there. There already is a requirement that we give notice to these tenants. We work our tails off to try and make sure that everybody gets the notice that's appropriate, and we don't shut things off. What this does is put on an additional burden on us to do a particular kind of notice to a particular way of operating, which will either be more costly, may not work in our particular areas. Again, if there was a problem that somebody could point to where we have shut off electricity, where somebody has gone out in the cold, then we would be more willing to discuss things. But right now, we basically see this as a solution in search of a problem. I'm going to ask you not to pass it. Thank you.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, my name is Ted Case. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association, 18 electric cooperatives in Oregon, representing 200,000 members, some of the most rural and remote parts of the state. I want to associate myself with the comments of Mr. Romaine. I surveyed my membership to see if there's a problem in their service territories. I just want to give you a sample of some of the comments that came back. For one of my managers, who's been in the business a long time, he says, in my 24 years as manager, I cannot recall one instance where this has been a problem. Another manager noted, who's on the west side, I've been doing this for 33 years, and I don't recall this happening here. 99% of our renters pay their own utility bill. In a few cases where that's not the case, we have never shut off the renter's power because the landlord didn't pay the utility bill. I may note that we have very member-friendly disconnect policies. For instance, Umatilla Electric in Hermiston sends out 5 different notices before they even start the disconnection process. So this is not something that we do without a lot of deliberation. One of my co-ops noted that they, in the first case, in recent memory of a landlord not paying their bill, in this instance, the landlord was trying to evict the tenant by not paying the bill. The co-op refused to go along with this practice. They actually went and met with the tenant, brought them to the co-op, signed them up as a member, and long before the situation got out of control. So I don't think any notification policy from the legislature can really deal with what a very savvy meter reader can do in going into those communities that know these people and know what's necessary. With respect to the notification that's called for in the bill, in rural Oregon, as many of you know, some of these homes are a mile off the road behind a gate, a lock gate, and some of these people never even use their front door. Some of these people have dogs that are there to make sure that nobody leaves anything on their front door. So we don't have a lot of high-rise, multi-unit apartments in rural Oregon, but we do have single-family homes, farm homes that might be 150, 200 miles from the co-op. And instead of sending a notice to the door and doing a 400-mile round trip, we suggest that perhaps why don't we just let the co-op's procedures work. Probably somebody at the co-op knows that person in that home. Probably somebody in that co-op played high school football with somebody that is in that home, or maybe isn't related to the person that's in that home. So I agree with Mr. Romaine that this is a problem, a solution in search of a problem. We just don't think it's necessary for the legislature to take action on this, and appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It did sound like Ms. Hebb had some instances where your co-ops were involved with shutting off one of the cases, wasn't it?
Chair Shields, I'm not. I noted the towns that they were. I'm not sure that those were electric cooperatives. I'm not privy to that information. I've asked for that. I haven't seen the specific instances, so I'm just not aware who those are.
Fair enough. Okay. We appreciate you coming down to testify.
If I could just add one clarification. If I heard the proponents correctly, there was no instance where anything was shut off. It was almost shut off. And then it was because of the good work of the law center. And they do great work. I mean, I'm not trying to disparage that. They do great work. But so do the local utilities. They are the ones who get involved and try and make it work if they know there's a problem. Thank you.
And lastly, so there is a process for notification, you're saying, in somewhere within the policies and procedures of all of your organizations?
Chair Shields, every PUD has a policy that they follow. It may be a little bit different than the neighbor PUD just because they're different. Their constituency is different.
Okay. Good. Well, we've got to leave it there. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Yep. We will take this back up again at the next hearing.
Are we going to 180 over?
Yes. Yes. So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 490. We're going to roll over 490 and 628 for our next hearing on Wednesday. We also have a pretty full docket on Wednesday, so concision and people's testimony will be much appreciated. I apologize for the time constraints that we're hitting. It's just that time of the session. So, Ms. Jones.